This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I think it is going to be a judgment for Reform UK nationally as to how they perform in councils, and Kent is clearly identified as the flagship. How much notice of it people take? I think it's background noise for most people. I mean, clearly in Kent, it's something which draws a lot of attention because this is us. But across the country as a whole, I think if you get enough of a picture that Reform councils are struggling, then yes, I think it will not help them.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
In this week's episode, we hear how cash-strapped KCC might sell off one of its major offices to a London council to become an HMO. We investigate what happened when last there was a local government reorganisation in the county, and we ask how likely it is that Keir Starmer is about to be deposed by his own MPs. I'm Simon Findlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway.
Hello.
And senior editor Matt Ramsden, who is looking at what's been happening at Westminster in the absence of Nikki.
Hello.
Our special guest today is Conservative Roger Gough, the former leader of Kent County Council. First though, Rob, what have you been up to?
So later this month, Kent's councils will be submitting plans for different versions of local government reorganisation to central government. But I've been looking back at the last time local government was reorganised in Kent and saw the breaking away of the Medway towns from Kent County Council and forming Medway Council as a unitary authority, which is the type of council which this new reorganisation will create across the county in a couple of years. I spoke with a number of people who were there at the time about the process in the late 90s, the reasons in favour of the move, and some of the shenanigans which went on behind the scenes.
Well, what did you find then?
So I spoke with former Rochester City Council deputy leader, then deputy leader of Medway Council until 2000, Vernon Hall, who told me the dominance of West Kent Tories on KCC meant that Medway wasn't really getting the attention that it deserved. Additional powers, including control over health and education, were also big positives for the move. I also looked into the legacy of Rochester and Gillingham councils, which ceased to be on April 1st in 1998, how Gillingham Borough Council used a lump sum in its final years to purchase the Sunlight Centre, which is still going now and provides pharmacy and GP services, as well as other community services such as Men in Sheds and a support cafe. There were some parallels with the current reorganisation effort, and one person I spoke to who had gone through it the last time around, so the process becomes 10 times harder when there's a local opposition, meaning that back in the 90s, the government had to step in and make the final decision. With the various conflicting plans going in at the moment, it'll be interesting to see how similar the process is a second time round. You can read the full piece on Kent Online on Sunday.
Okay, Matt, what's been happening in Westminster then?
Well, I can hardly believe I'm saying this, Simon, but there are increasingly strong rumours about moves within Labour to unseat Sir Keir Starmer as Prime Minister just 18 months after he moved into Downing Street.
Where do these rumours come from, and how much credibility do they have?
Well, there's definitely something going on, as Starmer allies have let it be known that any attempts to unseat him would be fought. Labour members are starting to panic as the opinion polls are looking increasingly bad, and this month's budget is almost certainly going to darken the public's mood with tax hikes likely coming our way.
Is it likely that a Prime Minister with a net approval rating minus 45 is likely to survive this?
Well, Labour Party rules traditionally make it very tricky and to easily get rid of a leader. But who knows? There are always rumours about Wes Streeting, who is by far the best communicator in the Cabinet, and Andy Burnham, who'd need to find a constituency as he's a current mayor of Manchester. But the whole thing is bizarre when you remember that Starmer commands a parliamentary majority of 170. But as Boris Johnson and Liz Truss discovered, plotting can easily become contagious.
Okay. We're going to return to this subject a little bit later on.
Sir Simon, another quiet week at County Hall.
You must be joking. Amid the sort of general chaos of what's been happening in County Hall the last sort of 3.5 weeks, another story came my way which showed perhaps what was going on behind the scenes. Some leaked documents that show KCC-owned Invicta House in Maidstone may become the target for houses of multiple occupancy by a London borough. And just for background, Invicta House is a 65,000 square feet office right next to County Hall, close to Masonic Station, which is up for sale. Under the previous administration, the Tories, it was due to be retained and County Hall would be sold. The thinking then was that with £14 million worth of improvements, Invicta House could become part of the new council set up after the local government reorganisation and get rid of County Hall, which is a magnificent building but a total money pit. So anyway, it was put up for sale and a buyer was found, but when the Conservatives were booted out and Reform UK came in, they announced that they're going to sell Invicta House instead and spend a bit of money just making County Hall usable once more. before, recent papers that were not shared with the public or the press shed little light on the likely future use of Invicta House. The papers say that one of the most attractive future possible uses would be for high-density HMO studio and one-bedroom apartments, and with interest probably coming from London boroughs who have all got housing shortages themselves.
So why is this not a good option?
Well, I mean, for a start, the people from London boroughs tend to be homeless. They tend to be people who have been evicted. They don't have friends. They don't have family or ties with the new community they've been sent to. And they often don't have very much support either. So, I mean, the papers say that sending people to Kent and Maidstone in particular have meant that there have been sort of antisocial issues linked to those properties that have been sent for that use in the past. But, however, should Maidstone Borough Council come in for the building, and it's worth around about £3.3 million, it could have a more locally focused use in the future. But these buildings are attractive also because you don't need planning permission to convert them, and they are also unattractive as office accommodation because few people need offices in Maidstone, even though the block comes with 250 parking spaces. But as it stands, an HMO by London Borough would seem to be the least popular but most likely outcome unless some form of covenant is attached to it to stop it. But such a covenant, which might prevent the sale to a London Borough for HMO use, might also make it unsellable.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Having lost his position as Kent County Council leader and his council seat in May's local election, Roger Gough would have been more than a casual observer of Reform UK's stewardship at County Hall this past 6 months. He joins us today to speak about how he thinks things are going there and what people in Kent should be keeping an eye on in the future. Roger, welcome. 6 months have passed since your administration was dumped out of office in what I think you described as an apocalyptic defeat. What have you been up to since?
Well, I had, I think I said when I was on here before, which was just a few weeks after said apocalypse, there was a moment actually of just being able to decompress a bit. I mean, you don't realise until you stop just how much the role involves. And it was in many ways, there was an opportunity there just to pause, take stock. It was quite nice also that as it happened, my daughter was doing her A-levels shortly after that. So I was around for those. But as I said, I'd been thinking through quite carefully because you didn't need to be the greatest political analyst to see that this or something like it was coming. I had been thinking a bit about what I would be doing. And so over time, a number of things have emerged. I'm pursuing some work still to do with local government. Mm-hmm. Again, when I was here, I said I hoped that
something would come off.
I hope the experience that I built up, 20 years as a councillor, about 17 of those either as 17, probably 18 of those either as a cabinet member or as leader, that can be of some value. So I'm doing some work with the local government association and providing some support to some other councils actually, and other programs, and that's actually tremendously rewarding. I've got another role with a cross-party group in Parliament, which I've done some work with in the past. And then aside from that, those are the two, if you like, paying roles. I've got an academic affiliation up in Cambridge, and one or two other bits of writing and so on that I'm doing, and a number of other things I'm pursuing. So I think if compared with what I was thinking might be the case when we last spoke, it's turned out quite similar, but slightly different. And I think there are probably still ways in which what I do will take a little while to settle. But particularly the last couple of months, it's taken on some very definite shape.
Okay. Your victors, Reform UK, under their leader, Lyndon Kemp-Caron, have also been in charge for 6 months. How do you think they're getting on?
As you know, I was very careful to say that I was not going to sit there sniping at my successors, because I think that's it's not helpful, it's not seemly, and I don't think it's what people would want or expect from me. And so I've tried to be quite sort of dispassionate in my analysis. And I would add also, I naturally have a degree of empathy for anybody trying to do this role, because I know from long and hard experience just how tough it is. So I'm not unsympathetic. Actually, my biggest beefs are not with the people who are seeking to run Kent. Many of them I don't even know, so I don't know all the ins and outs of individuals. I do know Lyndon moderately well and always had actually quite a decent relationship with Lyndon. But really, my concern was and is what I think is a nationally driven reform project, which certainly at the time of the election did not take seriously what are the big problems facing local government. So it was all run on the basis that somehow if you sacked enough woke people or whatever, then somehow you could freeze the council tax and fix the potholes and all the rest of it. Well, that was predictably not going to be viable as a way of doing things, and it's not. So I think the problems that they are facing are, by and large, not of their making. They're the problems that we all faced, faced, or some of my colleagues still face in local government. What I do find more open to criticism, if you like, is that there was a political program which suggested that somehow there were simple answers to these problems, and there aren't. And I'm not sure that there's been a full-hearted engagement with those problems even now. Mm-hmm. Certainly a lot of the style of governing has been about headlines and about, again, coming up with what claim to be great savings, great solutions, which, again, don't take very long to unpick for not being so. Yeah. So I think that's been the picture.
Okay. When you saw the video of Lyndon Kemp-Caron shouting and swearing at her councillors on that video that was leaked to The Guardian, how did you react to that?
I think, firstly, you never know with these things what the overall context is. So I would hesitate to rush to judgment on it. I also understand that group meetings can occasionally be less than secure, as I seem to recall from my own past, Simon, and well, you know all about that, but
I don't know what you mean.
I'm sure now, and I'm sure you couldn't possibly tell me anything about it now. But so I think, you know, clearly it is, as I've said earlier on, it's a difficult gig and there's a lot of pressure there. But ultimately, I think the administration will be judged, certainly should be judged, not particularly on an incident like that, but more on what they deliver in terms of serving the people of Kent. That's what ultimately it will come back to. And as I say, I think it was always going to be difficult for them for a number of reasons. One is it is a difficult situation. As I say, you know, we come back after May, which admittedly was always at the unlikely end of possibilities, but had we done so, we would have faced huge challenges. And I don't think we ever concealed that. So it is a genuinely difficult situation because local government as a whole is in a difficult situation. Yeah. It was also hard for them when it's a group of, well, it was then 57, it's obviously now, 48, but people who, by and large, as far as I understand it, didn't know each other. And
very little experience as well.
And very little experience.
Including Lyndon. I mean, you know, she may have had some sort of experience standing in elections, a couple of elections, but she had no actual local government experience at all, and nor does her deputy or her chief whip and most of the cabinet.
No, that's right. I mean, the only person that I'm aware of, in fact, I'm pretty certain it is the only person who's had, you know, KCC experience is Diane Morton. And she's, you know, as the adult social care portfolio holder. Obviously, I know Diane very well from when she was in the Conservative group and always got on with and liked her very, very much. But, you know, she's the only one, pretty much. And yes, so all that is difficult. I know, again, from experience, when you step into that role, there's elements of it that nothing prepares you for. And it's genuinely very tough, even if you've been experienced. It's going to be a lot harder if you don't have that experience. So put all those things together, it was always going to be difficult. But as I've said, I don't think they helped themselves by several things. One is the platform on which they stood, because that pretended, as I say, that there were nice, simple answers to the problems, and there aren't. The second, which I think is a unique feature, as far as I can see, very much looking in from the outside of Reform UK, is the degree of intervention and presence of the party centre. I had huge numbers of gripes about my party in government, and what it was, you know, whether it was doing things that were helpful to Kent or helpful to us or not. One thing they never did was intervened in how I ran the council.
Do you think there's too much interference from
I think it's very evidently the case. You can see that from even what's been publicly released. And I think that puts them in many ways in a difficult situation. The final thing I think is, I don't know what's been going on. I've been out of it and kept myself deliberately at a distance. But it's not shouting to me at the moment that there is still the right degree of serious engagement with the really, really gritty problems the council faces.
Mm. So with all of that in mind, Roger, I mean, we've had 5 expulsions, 3 suspensions, 1 defection, all in the first 6 months. If Kent fails as a reform project, does that put the kibosh on Nigel Farage becoming Prime Minister?
I don't think it would put the kibosh on, but I don't think it helps them nationally. Again, let's look a little bit wider than Kent. There are reform councils in a whole number of parts of the country, and many of them are facing, again, big challenges, whether in particular, for just about all of them, the reality of what it is they've got to deal with as an administration has come as an unpleasant shock. Interestingly, I wonder whether it's been a problem for them, again, not just in Kent, where they've ended up taking full control and having, as I say, a disparate group who don't know each other, all trying to come together to govern. I was at an event a week or two ago where it happened that the new leader of Warwickshire, 19-year-old leader of Warwickshire, he spoke, and I must say he actually made quite a decent impression. And I think part of it is that, as he acknowledged, they're working there in a minority administration. And I wonder whether, in a sense, it might have been easier for them, a more natural transition in, if they'd been able to work as a, work more with other parties in a case of having to, rather than being sort of standing alone. I think it is going to be a judgment for Reform UK nationally as to how they perform in councils, and Kent is clearly identified as the flagship. How much notice of it people take? I think it's background noise for most people. I mean, clearly in Kent, it's something which draws a lot of attention because this is us. But across the country as a whole, I think if you get enough of a picture that reform councils are struggling, then yes, I think it will not help them.
Well, Reform UK came in making some pretty bold statements and about finding savings and all the rest of it. But as the council has admitted this week, adult social care is always going to be the rising cost. Will make it very, very tricky for them to set a balanced budget. Do you think this will trip him up?
I think it is the heart of the problem. Now, the truth is there are a number of areas of pressure that local government is facing. And certainly when we, a couple of years ago in my administration, we confronted a summer of intense budget pressures. And that was really focused on 3 areas. Adult social care, children's services and the placement costs in those, and special educational needs, particularly the transport side when you're looking at the day-to-day budget. And each of those was really giving off smoke, if you like. We did make quite a lot of progress in the other two, and some of that's continued. So we've seen, certainly, if you look at the most recent budget statements, the children's budget overall is there or thereabouts. It's pretty much in line.
Yeah, everything's either just under or just slightly
exactly.
over, yeah.
And in fact, on the SEN transport side, we delivered big underspend last year, and that seems to be continuing and being taken further. So that's all good. The area of intense pressure, as you say, is adults. That is continuing to be more than the total of the projected overspend. It's a deeply difficult, intractable area. So I think it is the area that they're most going to struggle.
Yeah. One thing I've always been interested in finding out is what makes adult social care so expensive? I understand people are living longer, people are sort of having longer, more infirm lives, etc. But that can't be the only thing that's making... What are the other pressures that are driving this enormous rising cost? And it's an unpredictable cost as well, because you know in the first quarter there might be an overspend of, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 million, and then, but they're never quite sure how much it's going to be the next quarter or the quarter after that. So it makes it really difficult for you guys, especially when you've not been getting, you know, long term fixed budget settlements. You've been doing them year to year. That must have been a terrible pressure. But just going back to that question, is what drives the expense of adult social care?
Underlying it all is the fact that at a national level, it's never been given the priority it should have been given. And therefore, it's been under a kind of squeeze over the years, and that has all sorts of effects. So one is, for example, you end up in many places with quite a weak or fragmented, often actually not very sufficient, provider market. And that then means that sometimes you'll end up buying services in at the margin, and that can be very expensive at spot. The second thing is that we've had an absolute sort of whipsaw of national policy over actually very much related to migration policy and to the labour force in adult social care. And there are big labour shortages. There is an inconsistent approach to that. And again, we've never sorted out as a country the degree, giving that sort of career, the degree of priority that it should be given. So again, you've got shortages in lots of areas. One of the core things, which of course has been a big short-term impact, has been the national insurance changes, which have put pressure on providers. And that was one thing which we were discussing with the social care providers as we were seeing that coming through beforehand. So there's a lot of areas. There's also, of course, always a big challenge at the interface with the NHS and how that plays out. So all those things put pressure on. But what we've also seen, I think, is that particularly since the pandemic, the complexity of cases has increased. And that has meant that even if you don't get big increases in volumes, and when I last looked at it, the numbers coming in were, there were some increases and there were certain areas like those related to mental health, which were increasing quite sharply. But the much bigger impact was in unit cost, if you like. That was partly because of some of the things I've described, but it was partly also because people's needs become more complex. And the only way you're going to address that is really get upstream, deal with some of those problems at a much earlier stage. Mm. And unfortunately, all the constraints that we've been under over the years have made it hard to do that. Mm. And that's, again, a national problem. So I think there is a huge structural problem there in adult social care. And the sad thing is, it is such an important service. It's an afterthought by comparison with the NHS in terms of national policy making. The end result is you get, you know, huge problems, which mean people don't necessarily get the care and support that they should get, and they don't get it early enough. It costs a lot more. And actually, it makes adult social care a less effective partner for the NHS as well. So I think all of those are the factors that lie behind it.
Okay.
Can I just add one thing on that as well? Mm. Always remember, too, when we think about adult social care, I think the mental picture we all have is to do with older people.
Yeah.
And that is a big part of it, but it's not the whole story. A huge part of it is learning adults with learning disabilities, working age. That's been a very, very significant factor too.
Mm. I mean, it's safe to say that Lyndon Kemp-Kerran hasn't had the best of months, starting with that leaked video that we spoke about and all the other issues within the party, people being suspended and expelled. Can she survive as leader of her party and of KCC?
I am not particularly well qualified to judge that because, as I said earlier on, I know Lyndon a bit. I don't know her group. I don't know. I know you had Andrew Kennedy on the show last week, and Andrew was, I think, giving some judgment on that and, frankly, is closer to it than I am. As I say, going back to my original starting point, you know, I have a lot of empathy for anybody trying to do the job of leader because it is such a challenging one. How she will, you know, respond to this from here, we will have to see. But I think either way, you know, whether it is her or whether it, you know, if there were to be any change, but either way, it's going to remain a really, really difficult task. And so I would trust that she, or indeed any successor, sort of invests in their own resilience as well, because it's going to be a tough job.
Is it a job that you would fancy taking back on?
Depends what you mean. Look, if there was, in some strange parallel universe out there, if some genie said to me, "You have it, you can have it back, and you can have it back now," I'd say, "Yeah, absolutely, in an instant." I mean, it was an extraordinarily stretching and demanding, but also very rewarding thing to do. But no, I mean, that was a time in my life. It came to an end. Came to an end rather abruptly on the 2nd of May. And if you are sensible, you move on from that. So I have absolutely no illusions about, or wish, frankly, to do that or something similar.
Yeah. What do you think the Conservatives have to do to get back in charge of KCC?
Well, I think, again, Andrew,
sit tight?
I don't think you can simply sit tight. Now, the truth is, particularly as a council group, your fate is utterly predominantly out of your hands. It's out of your hands partly because it'll depend on how the ruling administration does, but it will also depend on the national climate as well. You know, we won 62 seats in 2021. We won 5 in 2025. Were we really that much worse 4 years on? No, we weren't. It, you know, the main factor was that the national levels of support that the Conservative Party had, if you take a snapshot of those two dates, roughly halved. So there's a great deal that's not within your gift. I think that patient work to ensure that the party is able to, and its representatives, are able to make a good contribution to debate about the future of the county council or indeed successor councils, because there probably won't be another KCC election. Mm. But either way, the party, I think, can do a certain amount to rebuild its standing within Kent. More of it will come actually out of its success, hopefully, in rebuilding its position nationally, mm. to which in Kent you can make a contribution.
Yeah,
but it's kind of circular.
But you can't obviously rely on reform just hemorrhaging yet more of its councillors.
No, and look, I think when you're a party in opposition, you've got to work to do all the things you can which are within your gift.
Mm.
Now, if you're realistic, you'll know which things are not. But even, frankly, if you are the main opposition, which at county level, of course, at the moment, we're not.
Mm.
But even if you are that, no sensible party sits there and says, well, we'll just wait for this to come to us. Mm. It doesn't work like that. I think there is work to be done I'm sure the team in County Hall are working on that hard and effectively, but you do what you can, and the rest of it, as I say, is slightly outside your control.
Roger, listen, thank you very much indeed for your time today. As we spoke about earlier, Sir Keir Starmer faces a potential coup following the budget, which is likely to see Labour's approval rating sink even further. But surely he survives, shouldn't he? Robert, what do you think?
I think at the moment, yes, I think he will survive, just on the pure facts of Wes Streeting has been floated as the possible replacement for him, and he's made clear that he's not particularly interested, or at least not at the moment.
Well, I heard he was on manoeuvres, actually.
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a funny thing. I always think most leaders fall into the pit of always denying that something's going wrong, and Keir Starmer's number 10 seems to be going for the tactic of saying that everything's going wrong and he's in a nest of vipers and they're all attacking him at the same time. I'm not really sure what the strategy is with that.
Well, according to what I've been reading, is actually the possibly the exact opposite. That number 10 has been sent out to attack all the possible rivals that are in the cabinet, people like Bridget Phillips and Wes Streeting, and they've been actively sort of so that they've been on the attack. And
well, that's what I mean in terms of I don't really understand why number 10 wants to paint all of its cabinet members as people who are just waiting for the right moment to stab Keir Starmer in the back. I don't really get what the point of that is, other than to sort of say, you know, Keir Starmer's not going to give it up easily. I think at the moment he's incredibly unpopular, that's undeniable. Yeah. The question is whether you go, as I've sort of suggested a couple of times before, sort of along the Justin Trudeau route of he soaks up as much of the bad will and you find somebody, a challenger who, you know, would be, I think, ideally outside of the cabinet to come in and say, look, we're making a total break from what Keir Starmer was before, and hopefully, you know, boost that popularity like Mark Carney did in Canada. Whether that would work, whether there's a suitable alternative candidate, I just don't see that at the moment. So I think Keir Starmer will limp on.
Yeah, I did hear that if you want a leadership challenge, you've got to find 80 MPs, and that if Angela Rayner put herself forward, she would find 80 MPs in a heartbeat. But equally, there's an observer on the radio last night was saying, what you said was basically you looked for somebody outside of the cabinet, and that's where they think that possibly the next person will come from, if there is one. It really remains to be seen how much further the popularity drops in the light of the budget. And if he gets through the budget and then gets through Christmas and then gets through into the May elections, and they're as bad in Scotland, Wales and in England as they think they've got to be, how much longer they can possibly hang on to him for. Matt?
Yeah, I mean, changing leader doesn't change the fundamentals of the situation that Britain finds itself in. You know, we're facing record debts, we're paying more tax than ever before, we've got a budget coming down the road which is going to put more tax on more people. Someone needs to be grown up and say, look, we're on the bones of our backside and, you know, we need to take tough choices. And Labour haven't helped themselves by backtracking on some policies like welfare reform, which would have helped them. They would have helped them out of the financial hole. But because they're pandering to their MPs, it just makes life very difficult. And I suspect that a lot of MPs from the Labour side see blood in the water with Starmer and think they'd rather have Angela Rayner in charge. But whoever takes over from him, if he is deposed, will just inherit the same fundamentals. Mm. And they're not going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
I think although Keir Starmer is sort of the headline figure in this and who people are talking about being deposed, I think the more significant person is Rachel Reeves. And I think basically it's the fact that Keir Starmer won't get rid of Rachel Reeves. And
well, because every PM that ever gets rid of a chancellor doesn't end up surviving themselves.
Exactly. So it's a case of in order to get rid of her, because I think that there is a lot of frustration among backbenchers about her fiscal rules being too tight as they see it and too limiting in the scope of what the government can achieve from their mind's eye. So I think it's a case of they would want to get rid of Starmer if this ever does happen, to open up those rules, allow more borrowing and this sort of thing, to invest would be their argument. But it's a dangerous road. And as Matt says, you know, it doesn't change a lot of the difficulties that the country faces.
It really goes to the heart of how unserious our national politics has become over the last 10 years. There's been so much dysfunction in Westminster. You can probably say it started with Brexit and the Brexit wars, and it's gone on and on and on. Boris Johnson was deposed by Twitter. Liz Truss went quickly as well. And it just seems that we lack the number of serious people at the top of our politics that we need to say, look, we're in a hole. You need strong and stable leadership, as someone once said, and we just need to tough it out, rather than play these political games, which I think the public are just sick and tired of.
Yeah, you say sick and tired. I mean, someone used the word the other day, exhaustion. People are exhausted by it.
Yeah, I think so. I was mentioning before that I saw some commentary around the Remembrance Day service, and people were pining for John Major. And I'm old enough to remember John Major was massively unpopular.
Yeah.
But the people look back at him now and think, actually, he was
a halcyon, right. Halcyon days, yeah. And he was the sleaziest government of my lifetime, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and Simon, what about you? I mean, if you were a betting man, does Starmer stay? Does he go?
Nah, he's gone. I think
really?
I think he won't get beyond May. I think they'll plunge so far in the polls. Unless they have some sort of mini uplift, I don't think he can survive.
Yeah. And what about you, Rob? If you were a betting man, who comes next?
Probably the most likely candidate is Angela Rayner. Her being, you know, deposed as deputy leader is probably actually the best thing that has happened to her, in the sense of she's now outside the tent. She has a different political sort of philosophy and economic vision than Keir Starmer, and it is one that is popular with the members. So I could see it being her.
I mean, something that we're not talking about, and it might sound totally ludicrous, is that the budget isn't as bad as we think it's going to be. Everyone's talking it down and saying we're all going to get walloped with 2p on income tax, but that might not happen.
But it might not happen, but then May will happen. May will happen.
Yeah.
And the polls are so appalling that it's difficult to see how they can claw something back. And this may be an election right across the board, whether it's in the Senedd in Wales or whether it's up in Holyrood or in any of the councils in England. What will happen is it'll be the tactical vote that shapes the eventual result, but it won't be a result in favour of Labour.
Yeah. I mean, I would go back to a point I probably made quite a few times before, in that, you know, if you were to look at the Conservatives under Margaret Thatcher, her first term, and ahead of the 92 election, they were supposed to be defeated, and they won both those elections, 83 and 92, because things did feel better all of a sudden.
Yeah, but you'd also say that if they'd lost in 1992, then the Tories wouldn't have had to spend quite so long in opposition, because Kinnock would have been in charge. But that's a different sort of historical precedent, you know. But yes, you're right about Margaret Thatcher's first term. She wasn't doing very well. She had a terrible communication problem, like Starmer. She had a presentation problem, like Starmer. And so there are some parallels. And then she, you know, she won the 1983 general election with a landslide.
Yeah,
but that was off the back of the Falklands War, of course. But unless Starmer can find a war somewhere,
yeah, well, we don't want to depend on. That's in mind. But can I just make a quick point and ask Robert a question, if I may? Robert, Simon touched on there about presentation. I mean, Starmer is lousy when it comes to presentation. Clearly, a very intelligent, highly educated, well-meaning guy, but when it comes to communication, he isn't great. Why does that matter?
Well, I mean, it's a case of people look at the government and they want to feel confidence. And if basically the guy who's in charge isn't sort of not pulling rabbits out of hats, but basically making the government seem competent and interesting and dynamic, a grey man in a suit coming out and saying, oh, everything's going to be fine, doesn't really, you know, it doesn't strike you as an ideas man, that he's, you know, thinking outside the box and making loads of really interesting decisions. And so if you're sort of, as we are at the moment, I think, in the country, sort of feeling that we're kind of a bit stuck, you know, in a rut and not really developing or going anywhere, you need somebody dynamic who looks as if they're going to come up with some interesting ideas to get us out of a funk. And Keir Starmer just doesn't appear to be that.
Okay, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Matt and Rob for their contributions and to our special guest, Roger Goff. Don't forget you can keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. You can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.